thank you very much, Bruce, for kind introduction and for putting on such a nice breakfast. And now that we're adequately caffeinated, we can make a start. Yes, I was briefly a temporary resident of Canada. One winter was enough. But it's a pleasure for me to be here, and it's pleasing indeed to see this chamber contributing to the interaction between our two countries. It's surprising, actually, to me that Australians and Canadians don't compare notes more often, given how much we have in common. Apart from the shared heritage in the British Commonwealth, notwithstanding, of course, the French heritage in Canada, we're both federal states, constitutional monarchies. We're both countries that have small populations inhabiting a very large and in some ways inhospitable landmass. We're both commodity producers, and we're both open economies for whom open trade and capital flows are very important. So that's quite a lot in common, geographically rather separate, of course, but quite a lot in common in other respects. So I want to talk about a little bit about similarities and also some rather, I think, informative differences in the way economic trends have gone over the past several years. And then I want to look at towards the end, at some common interests that I think we have looking into the future as the international economy and financial systems evolve. In covering those issues, I'm mindful that David Dodge, the former governor of the Bank of Canada, addressed this group just a few years ago. And I find myself in sympathy with and repeating some of the sentiments that he expressed at that time. Well, Australia and Canada have very similar levels of per capita income, about $37,000 per head for Australia, $39,000 for Canada in 2008. Here in Australia, our growth of real income per head has been a little higher than Canada's over the past 15 or 20 years, but in many respects, fairly similar experiences. I'm going to see if this works. Oh, how about that? In terms of structure, I don't normally do PowerPoint, but I thought maybe because it's early and to keep your interest, we have a little bit of a show for entertainment. The primary sectors of the two economies are of similar size and perhaps a little larger than in the average industrialised economy. Australia has less manufacturing but more mining than Canada, and there are some notable differences within the mining sectors, and that turns out to have been important over recent years, as I'll show in a minute. But overall, I suppose one could say that the structures of the two countries at a broad level are reasonably similar. Trade and financial flows between Australia and Canada are in fact fairly small, and I know that the Chamber's doing its best to make that grow, and I support that endeavour. At this point, as far as Australia is concerned, trade with Canada is only about 1% of our trade, and Canada accounts for about 1% of total foreign investment received by Australia. But trade overall is very important to both countries. Exports account for a little under a quarter of Australia's GDP and more than a third of Canadian GDP. Commodities make up a significant share of the value of merchandise exports in both cases, although they're more important in Australia's case because Canada also has sizable exports of manufactures, particularly machinery, equipment, and motor vehicles. The composition of the exports also varies a little bit in that Canada's commodity exports include quite a bit of crude oil, natural gas and forestry, while, as you can see here, Australia actually has quite big shares in coal and iron ore. And that's quite important. Now, as you know, commodity prices vary quite a bit over time, driven largely by the ebbs and flows of the world business cycle. So that means that fluctuations in the terms of trade for both countries are quite important. By terms of trade, what I mean is the relationship between export prices and import prices. You can think of the terms of trade as the purchasing power over imports of our export basket. So when our export prices rise relative to import prices, we are wealthier because we have more purchasing power over the goodies produced by the rest of the world. So in Australia's case, a fact that I'm fond of quoting is that it takes many fewer tons of coal to pay for a plasma television set today than it did 10 years ago. That is, our terms of trade have risen, and we are, in that sense, wealthier. It turns out that if you plot the terms of trade for the two countries over time, until about 2000, these cycles tended to go up and down quite closely. In the subsequent global upswing, though, Australia's terms of trade tended to pull a fair way ahead of Canada's, as you can see. Between the beginning of 2002 and the middle of last year, Canada's terms of trade rose quite a bit, about 30%. But over that same period, Australia's terms of trade rose in excess of 60%. So why the difference? The answer is that the more rapid rise for Australia reflected the fact that our exports not only have a higher share of commodities, but a higher share of the commodities which experienced the largest gain in prices. And you can see that here. The biggest rises in prices proportionately were for things like coal and iron ore. All these commodities went up a lot, but those two in particular went up proportionately more steeply than the others. So Australia had a bigger boost in the terms of trade because of that. Having said that, Canada's trade share of the economy is larger than ours, so even though their terms of trade rise itself was not quite as big, the income gain that comes from this terms of trade rise was still pretty significant, even if not quite as big as we had in Australia. Well, income gains from the terms of trade are expansionary for the economy. Because it's more income, there will be more demand. You would expect countries that have this shock to have stronger growth in demand relative to capacity. You'd expect it to have more risk of inflation, a necessity for higher interest rates, and a rise in the exchange rate relative to countries who did not have terms of trade gain. And so it turned out in both our countries. In the terms of trade upswing, both countries saw growth above average. Interest rates and exchange rates rose, and there was some upward pressure on inflation. There were, nonetheless, some interesting differences here. One was that the Australian dollar did not rise as much as the Canadian dollar, which I think is surprising, given the greater rise in the terms of trade that we had. Australia also saw stronger growth in total demand in the economy than Canada did. And associated with both those trends was a more pronounced rise in inflation at the end of the upswing. So we struggled to contain inflation to our target. The Bank of Canada had some pressure but has had a bit more success in the past couple of years than we have in keeping inflation to their target. As the Canadians here would know, the Bank of Canada's target is 1 to 3, ours is 2 to 3 on average, and Bank of Canada has actually done quite a good job there over the years in keeping to that target. Having said that, while we had some pressure on inflation in this episode, it's important to note that compared with other large terms of trade episodes, we had a lot more success at containing inflation this time. And to illustrate that, here are three episodes of terms of trade gains for Australia. One in the early 50s, this was the Korean War war boom. The mid-1970s large run-up in commodity prices, and then the most recent one. And for a start, you can see that this was the biggest terms of trade episode of those three. You can see also that in the previous two, inflation went way up to 25-odd% in the early 50s, about 18% in the mid-70s, and we peaked at 5% this time. So in historical perspective, we've done a lot better this time at containing the inflation pressure, and that, I think, reflects a number of economic reforms that have been done over the years, not least a floating exchange rate, a much more flexible set of labour market arrangements this time, and a stronger framework for monetary policy. They're just three, and there are other things helping as well. Well, that's the preceding episode of the Terms of Trade run-up. As you can see in the chart here, the Terms of Trade are now on their way down. The impetus from the global economy for both our countries has reversed direction in the past 18 months or so. Canadians would have sensed that change first, I think, because of the strong relationship to the United States, which takes three-quarters of Canada's exports, or, if you like, about a quarter of Canada's GDP. The weakness in the US took root really through 2008 as the problems in the mortgage market there emerged, and that reduced demand for Canada's exports and weighed on growth even while the terms of trade were still rising. In Australia's case, exports are not quite as big a share of the economy for us as they are in Canada, and our export destinations are more diverse and more oriented to Asia. So in contrast to the US taking three-quarters of Canada's exports, about one-fifth of our exports go to Japan, about a fifth at the moment, in fact, a fifth to China alone, and a significant chunk to countries like Korea and other parts of East Asia. So more diversity, more Asian orientation there. And initially, most of those Asian countries were not greatly affected by the global downturn. It was really only late in 2008, as the financial turmoil around the world affected household confidence and business confidence around the world, that a reassessment of prospects for Asia really occurred. Even then, to date at least, Australia's export volumes have not weakened as much as those of most countries. These are December quarter volume figures, which are the latest ones we have for Australia. And as you can see, in terms of the size of decline of exports, we're at the bottom of that list. Why is that? Well, one reason is that the slump in global trade has initially at least been concentrated very heavily in manufacturers, which is why many countries in Asia have suffered and why countries like Germany are also suffering quite big contractions in their economy. Another reason, and of course Australia has some manufactured exports, but it's a small share of total exports for us. Another factor is the stronger linkage of many of our key commodity markets into China, and China has actually seen a pickup in growth during the early part of 2009. Rather, Chinese industrial production fell for 4 or 5 months in the second half of last year, but they've made up all that gain during 2009. A similar pattern has been seen in Korea, which is another important partner for Australia. Industrial output suffered quite a severe decline around the turn of the year, but about half of that fall has been made up during February and March of 2009. Well, looking ahead, with commodity prices at present levels, Canada's terms of trade look like they're still above the average of previous decades. I'm just going to go back to that chart. So there's a little horizontal segment at the right-hand end there, which shows the average level of terms of trade for Australia and Canada, and it turns out they're about the same level there. So even with Canada's terms of trade falling a bit more, and we haven't got a forecast on that chart for them, they still look like they'll be a little above that long-run average. And we've got a forecast there for Australia falling about 25% from the peak, but still quite a long way above the 20-year average up to 2000. So despite the big fall coming, that's still a rather positive picture for Australia in particular. So I suppose to sum up that set of issues, not only did the economic upswing that ended in 2008 provide a bit more impetus to Australia than it did Canada, the ensuing downturn has not, at least so far, hit Australia as hard as it has hit Canada. It would appear to me, anyway, that on a comparison of these two countries, the loss of export volumes has not been as big a factor in slowing down overall demand in the economy in Australia's case. As for inflation, well, it's moderating now. The fall in CPI inflation in both countries overstates really the extent to which inflation is declining, because it includes the big fall in petrol prices or gasoline prices if you're from North America. But measures of core or underlying inflation are nonetheless trending lower. In our case, of course, we got to a higher peak, so inflation here has further to fall than in Canada to get back to our target. Let me talk then about a couple of key strengths that I think both countries have going into this episode. And one of the most important ones is the relative resilience of banking sectors. Notwithstanding the global credit crisis, both Canadian and Australian banks remain profitable and well-capitalised by private investors. And that's not something that a number of other developed countries can claim. For the 2008 reporting period, the return on equity for Australian banks was 17%. That's coming down a little in the most recent reporting for early 2009, but still a double-digit number. For Canada, the relevant comparison was about 14% for Canadian major banks. Now, both those numbers are lower than in the preceding few years, which, of course, were boom-time years for global banking, and as we now know, years in which risk was increasing dramatically. But they're still very solid figures. And it's noteworthy, I think, that financial markets express more confidence in asset quality and future earning potential for Canadian and Australian banks, so the two lines are over the top of each other here, than they do for American or European or British banks, if you measure this by the premium of market price to book value. So that's a good story. And why do we get that story? Well, I think a couple of factors are important. One is that in Canadian and Australian banking, the holdings of the complex securities, which are at the core of the problems over recent years, were very modest. A second reason is that there was more conservative lending practices by both Canadian and Australian banks in their home markets than had been the case in some other countries. Subprime mortgages accounted for 13 or 15% of the US mortgage market. In Australia, the corresponding number is about 1%, and in Canada, certainly less than 5%. So more prudent behaviour by the banks is paying off now. Both our countries, of course, have had regional booms in housing markets over recent years, associated with the run-up in commodity prices and the associated effects of drawing the productive resources to the regions and the industries where you wanted more workers, namely the energy sector and the mining sector. So, yes, house prices in Calgary or Perth outpaced the rest of the country by a fairly significant margin for a while. More recently, dwelling prices are tending to soften a bit. If we express this as a ratio to income, which is often done, it turns out that in Australia's case in particular, there's already been quite an adjustment here over several years, about 5 or 6 years, since the peak in 2003. Without there having been a particularly large absolute decline in dwelling prices. That's evidence, it seems to me, for at least the possibility that these adjustments can take place over lengthy periods without necessarily being terribly disruptive to the overall economy. Of course, with the economy in both cases, both Canada and Australia, contracting at present, both sets of banks are seeing some pickup in bad loans. But overall, in both cases, the household sector doesn't seem to be having terrible trouble servicing their obligations, in significant contrast to what we see in the US and increasingly in the UK. And that, of course, reflects the better lending decisions of our banks in earlier years. So I think there are some interesting similarities and differences there and some interesting common strengths between our two countries. Let me finish up then with a bit of a look forward. Of course, domestic policies can only do so much in the face of a serious international recession. Both our economies have slipped into recession over the past 6 or 8 months as those international forces have taken hold. But for the reasons articulated above, there are good grounds, I think, to feel that we're relatively well positioned to take part and benefit from a renewed global expansion when that begins. I think it's a bit early to say that that's beginning just yet. There certainly have been a number of things happening in a number of countries which are consistent with the view that a new international expansion will get underway towards the end of the year. That said, though, most observers think, and I think with good reason, that the new global expansion, when it does start, will probably initially be characterised by pretty modest rates of growth. But even with that near-term uncertainty, it does make sense to look further ahead. Let me then talk about a few common interests that I think Australia and Canada have at stake in the way the international community responds to the crisis and the way it seeks to shape the next expansion. First among those common interests is the openness of trade and capital flows. The extent to which trade flows slumped late in 2008, I think, gives you a picture of what could happen were trade barriers to go up around the world. Everyone would suffer, and they would suffer badly. That's fully understood at an intellectual level in just about every country now, I think. But we know that in times of domestic economic difficulty, the pressure for protectionism increases. So countries like ours need to keep making the points that free trade is not a zero-sum game. It's a positive-sum game. It spurs innovation, it increases global growth, and it raises living standards. Important, I think, to keep giving that message. Secondly, the continued development of many emerging economies will enrich many firms and enterprises in countries like ours in the future. But it will be sensible for emerging countries to have a different growth strategy in the years ahead, a strategy which relies less on the absorption of consumer products by consumers in the developed world, at least for some years. That will involve, roughly speaking, more consumption at home by those countries, more investment at home, and a step back from the scale of capital flows to the developed world that we've seen out of the emerging world in the past decade or so. That would be a rational choice for emerging market countries. But a lesson that many of those countries took from the Asian crisis was that such a strategy is in fact very risky, because the rules of international engagement didn't give adequate protection in times of difficulty. And the response of many emerging countries to that lesson was the large-scale build-up in foreign currency reserves that we've had over the past decade. That's a very costly form of international self-insurance for those countries, very much a second-best solution, but one that they adopted because the first best solution didn't seem to be available. So it's in the interests of developing countries to alter that growth strategy, but to do so they need confidence that the international system, its rules, its governance arrangements, its safety nets and so on, are fair and will work for the emerging world. At the same time, the countries that have dominated those governance arrangements up to now, which is the major countries, and which will have to accommodate the emerging countries as things change over the years ahead, will themselves want to have some confidence that we are all, the emerging world and the developed world, speaking from the same page about what we think the international financial architecture, the governance arrangements for the international financial institutions and so on, how that should all work. We all need to be on the same page there. Australia and Canada have a shared interest in fostering progress on these fronts, and that will involve encouraging both the emerging countries and the developed countries to shift in ways that accommodate the other. I know that my Canadian counterparts have worked assiduously on these issues over many years, and we support and admire those efforts. Thirdly, much work is being done, as you know, at the moment on what the international community can learn from this crisis episode in terms of regulation and financial structure. Well, Canada and Australia, as countries whose financial and regulatory structures have, it seems, performed pretty well in this episode, I think are well placed, possibly uniquely placed, to contribute to that discussion. I think we could both hope to bring a sense of emotional detachment and balance and perspective to that international discussion on regulatory reform. And that's helpful because that is a discussion which at times becomes quite heated. Well, let me conclude. The Great White North, to use that celebrated phrase, and the Great Southland, or the land down under here, have much in common as well as some informative differences. Sound policy frameworks and resilient business sectors are being tested right now, but they can meet that test. We both certainly have at this juncture much at stake in the global economy recovering to a path of sustainable and balanced growth over the period ahead. And there's plenty we can do together to promote our common interests in the world as well as our own interaction with each other. Part of this sharing of ideas and cooperation, I'm sure, will be spurred by a forum such as this, and I wish you every success in that endeavour, and I thank you for your attention.
John Ward, Brisbane Airport Corporation. There's a lot of commonalities between Australia and Canada that you've drawn on during your informative talk. Heavily among that is our leverage to the rest of the world, given our the export nature of our economies. Right. In the rest of the world, we're seeing a rather, to me, a worrying trend to having run out of puff on the interest rate front. Right. Start to, in my words, print money. I know they've got a better euphemism for that. Given our vulnerability and how we've imported the problems that the rest of the world has generated in the last couple of years, what are the levers that you and your colleague in Canada have to mitigate the importation of inflation that actions of the rest of the world might be generating in the longer term?
Well, that's quite a big question. You're quite correct to say that in a number of countries, interest rates have effectively got to what the central bankers call the zero lower bound. In fact, Canada is one of them. The short-term rate there is down pretty much to nothing now, and I know that my colleagues there have given some thought to so-called unconventional operations, should they be needed. I don't think they've concluded that they are needed yet, but they've very sensibly put out a framework for how they would use them if they were needed. I think in the long run, what will be key for not having inflation is that the relevant central banks, which would include the British, the Europeans, the Japanese, Canada, United States, have a reasonably clear numerical commitment to an inflation rate that's neither too low nor too high, and the independence to adjust monetary policy as needed to achieve that target. It certainly would be worrying if the sorts of operations that are being done now became a persistent state of affairs. That would be worrying. But I think what my counterparts in the relevant countries would say is that under the extraordinary circumstances they face, where they worry about the possibility of deflation, to do something which is itself somewhat inflationary relative to a deflationary baseline is the right thing to do, and that the key thing, of course, will be to know when to stop doing it and to reverse engines. Now, I think the best guarantee that that decision will be taken appropriately at the time is that the central banks concerned continue to have a commitment to price stability and the independence politically and so on to pursue that commitment. I think that remains in place at the moment. If that were to change, then that would indeed be quite worrying. But I don't think at the present time that's occurring. How would we cope with higher global inflation if that occurred? Well, I think the truth is that it's very hard to escape entirely scot-free from a big change in global inflation. In the 1970s, all countries had somewhat higher inflation. The better performers had not much more, and they managed to retain a fair degree of policy independence by having a proper domestic commitment to price stability, a floating currency, and so on. And countries like Germany, Switzerland did much better than everybody else by having those mechanisms. And I think in the scenario you paint, which I hope doesn't come to pass, we will continue to pursue a properly calibrated domestic policy aimed at our target, and the floating exchange rate will help us do that.
Governor Stevens.
Brian.
In the past, I think you've said that it's the level of interest rates that matters for the stance of monetary policy rather than changes in it. Do you still think that, or do you think that there is an argument to hold some bullets in reserve to provide an offset for some negative economic news that might come out?
Well, I think what I've said in the past is that the changes in interest rates are the things that get all the headlines, but it's the level you get to that does most of the work. I still think that's right, and of course the level of rates in Australia here is pretty low. It's in fact quite low compared with our history. It's rather high compared with many other countries because they are at the zero bound in many cases, as we were just saying. And I don't have much doubt that certainly for the household sector this is an expansionary setting of policy, and I think everything we see on the way household borrowing is responding to that confirms that. Do the changes still matter for confidence? Yeah, I think they do to some extent, and that is obviously a factor to keep in mind in the month-to-month tactical decisions, but I don't want to go too much further down that track lest we get talking about next month's decision, and that wouldn't be appropriate today, so I'll stop there.
Philip Lasker, ABC Governor. You spoke about, in your speech, you were saying that it makes sense to look further ahead, and particularly with governments now going into deficit, I can understand why. I just wanted to get your view on the growth forecasts, particularly the outlying ones, looking further ahead for the 10-11 year of 2.25% and also 4.5% thereafter. Many analysts and economists have described those forecasts as optimistic, very optimistic, not just the politicians. What's your view and why?
Well, as I read the forecasts, I think that those forecasts that are in the budget are not materially different to the two-year horizon that we have ourselves. The initial part of the forecast recovery is pretty slow, so it's below trend growth. If it's anything like a normal cycle at some point, and of course it might not be, but in every cycle at some point, you will grow faster than average. Because what tends to happen is you build up a lot of spare capacity in the economy in the downswing, and over quite a few years you're going to wind in that spare capacity. And it is, I think, quite feasible to expect above average growth for a number of years at some point during an economic upswing. It seems to me what the outlook is saying at present is we're not going to bounce back to above-trend growth very quickly. We're going to take a bit longer than might sometimes be the case to do that. And the reason for that is the world economy is likely to be a bit weak for a while because of the financial impediments that other countries face. Now, we don't face those impediments to anything like the same extent, so that's not a big factor here. Directly for us, it's an indirect factor because it affects all the other countries. But at some point in every other cycle, you get above average growth. Exactly when that is and by how much, no one can really know at this point. But I don't think it's you know, crazily optimistic to expect that will occur at some stage. Now, beyond that, I don't want to comment in detail about particular forecasts because this is 3, 4, 5 years ahead. And, you know, for the purposes of the budget, you have to make a forecast or an assumption that far out. But we all know that any forecast that anybody does that far out is got a wide margin of error around it. We have to accept that. But I don't think it's terribly unreasonable to think that there'll be above average growth a few years out there, no.
Governor Stephen, Sue Leon from RBC Capital Markets. Your speech this morning highlighted some differences between Australia and Canada, one of them primarily being trade. Your comments this morning about China sounded quite upbeat in terms of noting a pickup in growth. Just wondering how confident you are that this pickup will be sustainable, not so much over the longer term, but over really the next 12 to 18 months, particularly, as you say, if the global expansion, when it occurs, is pretty modest.
Well, that's one of the big questions. I don't think there's any doubt that there's a genuine pickup in economic activity, quite a significant one, happening in China in the first 4 or 5 months of this year. I think a wide range of data sets show that. And as we work out the quarterly growth numbers, and you have to kind of extract those through a sort of a mystical process out of the year-ended numbers that they publish, but I think it's pretty clear that quarterly pace of growth has picked up, and the March quarter was the best quarter for about three quarters. So it's real. The durability of it is the open question, and that is a question to which we don't really know the answer, I don't think, at this point. It has certainly, I think, been generated more or less entirely by domestic factors in China, not by a pickup in China's exports to the rest of the world. They remain quite weak. So it's largely, I think, domestically driven in China, and how durable that turns out to be, we don't yet know. But I guess for Australia, if it does turn out to be the case that China drives growth more with domestic demand in infrastructure-heavy, commodity-heavy sort of activity, that's quite important for us in terms of the terms of trade story that I mentioned before. So, you know, I think it's quite a significant development, but exactly how that will continue is as yet unclear. You know, we don't know the answer to that question. Well, it's factually correct. It's in the budget papers. Well, the government, it's their money. They own the bank. And they can choose, if they wish, to take part of the dividend this year or in the 9-10 year and part in some other year. That's been done a number of times before. The previous government did the same thing on some occasions. And as the shareholder, they have the prerogative of doing that if they choose. You know, there's not really much more to say about it than that. David.
Governor David Uren from the Australian newspaper. I was just wondering how, in the context of your comments about China, whether you see upside risks in the Australian economy over the next 12 to 18 months.
Stemming from China?
Stemming from China, or perhaps faster bounce back in growth?
Well, I think that if we were to see faster growth than anticipated, it would likely be because exceptional levels of pessimism in the business community gave way to something less pessimistic. And I think what's happening at the moment is that in a lot of businesses, there is a very strong premium on waiting. So people are saying, I had these expansion plans, I'm not going to can them, but I'm going to delay them and wait and see how things turn out. So I'm going to get my debt down, be more conservative with my inventories, slow my hiring, and just wait and see how things turn out because of the uncertainty. If there were some factor that somehow reduced that uncertainty materially, and I, you know, what would that be is the question. But if it happened, then it's plausible you could see a significant resumption of a lot of those expansion plans. I'm not saying that will happen, but if your question is what would be the most likely source of an upside surprise, I think it would be something like that for Australia.